Hey there, I'm Staff Sergeant Johnny Joey Jones. During my time serving with the United States Marine Corps, I was deployed as an explosive ordnance disposal, or what you might call a bomb technician, to both Iraq and Afghanistan. While I've seen and experienced some things that most people could never imagine, even I was amazed by some of the stories you're about to hear in this podcast. From Ed Calderon, a former paramilitary law enforcement officer from Mexico. Here is his story.
We screamed out, "These guys aren't cops." As they were put into a van, my friend took out a folding knife and slashed one of them across the neck.
You're listening to a story told by a man, not even 40 years old, who has survived a lifetime of harrowing situations fighting drug cartels in Mexico.
He was found probably 12 hours later with his ID screwed into his forehead, tortured to death, basically. You know, it scared the shit out of all of us.
Known by many as the Sneak Reaper, Ed Calderon has become something of an international legend because of the skills he cultivated, learning to survive moments like that. Welcome to Alchemy of Violence, Narcos, Reapers, and Survival. I'm your host, Staff Sergeant Johnny Joey Jones. Ed's boyish charm and teddy bear smile betrays a resume soaked in blood and a mindset that makes elite special operators nervous and maybe a little jealous. The Sneak Reaper was generous enough to share his story with us in a series of wide-ranging interviews while working south of the border during the summer of 2020. You can hear proof of Ed's environment throughout the podcast in the form of a rooster crowing in the background. A rooster whose story you'll want to hear. At the tail end of the year 2006, things were starting to look more like a war zone just a few miles south of the U.S. border.
President Calderon is taking a tough stand against organized crime and drugs.
The Mexican government is calling in its army to try to stem the tide of violence in that country.
Mexico's president was beginning a military-backed offensive on the drug cartels that had been kidnapping, killing, and corrupting his people for years.
Since December 2006, when President Felipe Calderon vowed to defeat the cartels, police officers and soldiers put their lives on the line every time they head out to do their jobs. Violent clashes, kidnappings, and gunfights in the street have killed some 4,000 people, including 450 police, soldiers, and prosecutors.
That moment grew into a conflict that would claim some 60,000 lives over the tenure of Mexican President Felipe Calderon, who shares no relation to Ed. But the violence certainly didn't end there.
Notorious drug kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman is on the run after breaking out of a maximum security prison for the second time, and it appears he used some secret tunnel.
To this day, the number of deaths attributed to Mexico's drug cartels since that offensive began is more than 150,000. Those tallies fail to include the missing persons cases in the country over that same period, which exceeds some 73,000. And they certainly include some Americans.
Funerals today for some of the American Mormons killed in Mexico. 2 8-month-old twins are among those being buried. The brutal massacre occurred in a mountainous area near the Sonora-Chihuahua border, where rival cartels are fighting a vicious turf war.
Ed was barely into his 20s when he found himself smack in the middle of those opening salvos in Mexico's war on the cartels. He was working as a law enforcement officer when he turned on the TV one day to find his president was declaring war on an enemy that Ed had known his whole life.
A lot of my friends basically went to work for the cartels right off the bat.
Ed clearly took a different route than his peers and has now become an icon among elite U.S. veterans and civilians alike, thanks to his not-so-ordinary skill set cultivated in a career fighting against Mexico's ruthless criminal syndicates.
That was my first lesson into how to get out of handcuffs, my 15-year-old kid.
It's a career that Ed miraculously survived. something that can't be said for many of his peers.
That's when we kind of realized that we were being targeted, that people had eyes on us.
He's been living in the U.S. some 3 or 4 years, fleeing the country where he was raised with the help of a few American Marines he was lucky enough to call friends. More on that in episode 4. He began discovering that his peers in the U.S., who were steeped in tactical knowledge and survival training themselves, were eager to learn from his experiences. So he started sharing his one-of-a-kind expertise with an audience that went beyond special operators.
Most people think that all the stuff that I show is just, oh, this is just in case you get kidnapped by the cartels. But you can apply this to a lot of bad situations.
From first aid classes to his more unorthodox and signature methods of emergency preparedness, Ed says his courses are in demand from civilians, law enforcement, and special operators during this pandemic.
The whole minimalistic approach that I take to things isn't because that's what I wanted to do. That's because I didn't have a choice.
He is now known by many as the Sneak Reaper, a moniker we'll explain in detail later, emblematic of both himself and a life philosophy of self-reliance forged in flame. From his careers past and present, to his family and childhood influences, and what he sees as an unprecedented uptick in cartel violence happening right now. This is his story in his words.
My name's Ed Calderon, born and raised in Tijuana, Mexico. Tijuana is it's the purgatory of Latin America in a lot of ways. It was one of the major crossing points for most migrants that wanted to make their way into the United States. And it was like a waiting room for people, you know? Some people cross and then were deported. And sometimes people stay and live in the waiting room. When I was growing up, it was pretty uncommon to be born in Tijuana. Most people migrate here or come here as kids. I was born in Tijuana. My parents were from Guadalajara, moved to the border because their parents wanted to look for jobs. Tijuana has always been kind of like a bastion of opportunities and work. So, you know, they moved here. Two brothers, one foster brother, and spent my young years basically just running around one of the most trafficked border cities on the planet, not just people, but also drugs and guns. It was pretty safe when I was growing up. I mean, safe in, you know, Mexico safe, which is probably a different type of safe. But it was it wasn't as rowdy and as you know, there wasn't as much murders as there are now. It's a border city, so I grew up with a weird cross cultural, like American culture on TV and shopping in the U.S. on Christmas, and it's a weird kind of place to grow up in where you're kind of like exposed to two nationalities in a way. That's where I got my English growing up in Tijuana. That's like a skill set you have to have, language skills. If you don't have them, you don't get far when it comes to the job market. You know, I started getting into skateboarding and to, you know, getting into trouble with my friends, graffiti, all that stuff when I was growing up. I was pretty reckless, and I liked the whole adrenaline rush. I studied medicine for a while. 9/11 happened.
Another plane just flew into the second tower.
And it basically put the economy in the toilet, and I couldn't afford to stay in medical school. So I had to look for options. Eventually, I found a newspaper article that wanted basically kids, young unmarried men without any kids. For a government position. Basically, it was a paramilitary type police organization that they were forming, and nobody believed that I could go through with it, and nobody believed that I could actually do it myself. So I decided to shave my long hair off and ship myself out to the academy. There was a whole phenomenon back then called Los Narco Juniors. Narco Juniors were basically cartel guys that came not from the poor communities, not from the rural communities, but from some of the well-off families in Tijuana. So you would have these kids that were basically bored and rich, that they started going into cartel activity, from trafficking to, you know, murders for hire, abductions, that type of thing. You know, a few of my friends growing up went into that life. It's high paying, you know, there's a lot of money to be made, very dangerous. The whole narco cultura was taking off, basically the glorification of the narco or the cartel culture. You would go to some of the nightclubs and you would see some of the guys wearing a silk shirt, you know, $40,000 worth of gold on their hands and maybe on their chest. You would see a lot of people with a lot of expensive things, but with bad teeth. You know, that's the way you could tell some of the new money over the old money. You know, bad teeth, but he's wearing about, you know, $5,000 worth of clothes. That's a pretty interesting way of telling some of these guys apart. A lot of my friends basically went to work for the cartels right off the bat. You know, they couldn't get into a college, they couldn't get into university. And public service didn't interest them, so a lot of them actually went that route. They sell you an image, they sell you a dream. You know, the easy money, the whole Robin Hood figure built around some of these cartel personalities. You know, a lot of these guys basically take the money that they make and invest some of that money into the towns they're from. And they're the heroes in the story, you know? In Mexico, the cops are never the heroes. They're always the villains. So if you take that government position, that government job, you're a villain. And that's an interesting way kind of to think about it. You know, funny to think that for a time, I didn't tell a lot of people what I did for a living. Even close people in my family didn't know that where I worked, because it was a thing to be ashamed of in a way in Mexico. Oh, you're a cop? Well, you know, you're probably corrupt. You probably do stuff for the cartels or whatever, you know. There was just no room for any sort of consideration as far as you were actually doing your job. On the other hand, you would see some of my friends that went into cartel work and their mothers would boast about their kids making money. You know, oh, look at the house that my kid gave me, that type of stuff. And that was applauded. You know, there's a reason why I nicknamed Mexico the upside down, because a lot of the values, flip in some of these communities, and it's not just the young people. Some of the older generation, you know, actually have the same mindset, kind of the same outlook, celebrating criminality over any sort of government rule, because, you know, they basically have been exposed to a corrupt government that goes back to the revolution, you know? So it was interesting going into that line of work and having to hide that from people.
For those who know Ed Calderon and those who will come to know him, a major inspiration for everything he does is his mother. And while she didn't approve of his career choice, her role in sending him down that path and helping him come out the other side is undeniable.
I had a very close relationship to my mom, and she was, the Crocodile Dundee, the survival expert. She knew a lot of things about life, and she had a myriad of skill sets, including she was a nurse. So she taught me how to be a healer from an early age and how to be kind of involved in the community. Anybody needed an injection or somebody had a weird rash or somebody was bitten by a spider, that type of stuff around the neighborhood where I grew up, my mom would get a knock on the door in the middle of the night and I would go and hold a flashlight for her, right? That was my mom. She very Catholic, she was a devout Catholic. She kind of raised us with that in the background, very strict upbringing. There was a little bit of a, you know, ear pulling, and you know, people that are Mexican, have Mexican mamas, will know what that's about. My mom went through a horrible childhood that she kind of every now and then she would talk about. She would write about it. I still have her notebooks where she would write some of her experiences when she was a kid. She grew up in a very rough Tijuana neighborhood. So she had experiences with guns and people shooting and that type of stuff. She was the one that would scream at my dad to stop when we would see a roadside accident. You know, my dad didn't want to stop. in a lot of ways, you know, my dad was the sensible one. And every time I would see some sort of roadside accident, my mom would kind of run in there. And of course, I would always run behind my mom to try and help her out. She knew how to apply tourniquets, you know. She knew how to suture. She knew all these weird things that when you're a kid, you know, that you consider them weird. Later on in life, I'm somewhere working professionally with armed people, and we're doing pretty important work, and lives are on the line. And I go back to my 13, 12, or 8-year-old self holding a flashlight for my mom. She was putting an improvised tourniquet on somebody, and I'm kind of replicating the same thing she showed me just off instinct. I thought, well, at least that's what it feels like, you know. She definitely influenced what I later kind of picked as a life path. Sometime in the early 90s, I was holding her hand outside of a gas station, and there was an open air market next to it, and these cars rolled up with people that apparently were cops, but to this day I don't know if they were or not. And one of them basically told, you know, somebody to stop, that they were the police. And then the other guy in the other and the other guy on the passenger side, it took out a little Draco. It's like a small AK-47 rifle from the floorboard of the car. And just shot this person. The guy who was shot seemed to be a kid, probably 17, 18, somewhere along those lines. My mom, without missing a beat, grabbed me by the neck, spun me around behind her, and got me behind the engine block of a car. Probably like an Impala or something like that. I can't remember. It's a pretty big car there. That was my first exposure to some of this cartel violence. This was kind of in the 90s where the Arellano Felix cartel was had a stranglehold when it came to anything that happened in Tijuana.
We now have in custody the head of one of the most notorious and dangerous drug cartels in history. Francisco Javier Arellano Felix was brought by the United States Coast Guard by boat into San Diego, where he was taken into custody by the DEA and U.S. Marshals.
Ultra-violent cartel kind of kept control over things. I remember my mom kind of talking to me about that whole thing later on. You know, I was young, really young, probably 13 or something like that. She was trying to explain what happened. And so I said, why did the cops do that to that person? You know, it's like I just witnessed an assassination, basically. And she said, I don't know. Hopefully you'll never have to see that again. And hopefully you can grow up to do something about it. That was like two things she said to me, and that kind of really kind of stuck in my mind afterwards. Being of a, you know, lower middle class kind of family, the expectation was that we would grow up and would go to the university and become some sort of electrical engineer or a dentist or a doctor or something like that. That was like the whole mindset. I've always thought that there is some sort of alchemy that happens when violence is around somebody. You know, so experiencing through true violence, be it by seeing it, or feeling it, or experiencing it directly. You know, something happens. Something happens to your mind or your brain chemistry. I think for some reason that experience kind of triggered something in my head. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but something definitely changed in my head when I saw that whole situation kind of play out.
Ed says something changed in him that.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Hey. But one thing that has not changed in his life, and that has become almost a calling card in his professional career, is the presence of knives. It's a skill he shares in the classroom, and it comes with obvious risk.
You cut yourself? Yes.
And like so many aspects of his sneak reaper skill set, Ed attributes his expertise with edged weapons directly to his mother.
I grew up in Tijuana, but we also had a farm. We had a pig farm for a long time. And I got to experience processing meat, processing my own meat, processing game that we would hunt at the ranch. So I grew up using blades as tools all my life. Later on in life, when I went into law enforcement, I saw everybody was carrying around blades, but most of these guys were city folk. they didn't know how to use a knife. They didn't know how to, use it properly. Some of them were cutting themselves, trying to cut, marijuana bales, or every now and then we'd find these drug loads and they were trying to cut them off and cut themselves. Another aspect of it was that a lot of them were carrying around knives as backup weapons. They carried around karambits or these ring Filipino knives or just odd knives. Everybody was carrying around something different. Eventually, there came a time when I was in a position where I could influence training and practices. I kind of went into the whole aspect of teaching some of these guys how to standardize what they were carrying. So everybody was carrying around the same thing. How to better use their tools and both as tools and as defensive options. So I kind of went around the block and studied a few systems out there and became an instructor myself. When it came time to carry something for myself, I quickly found out that my mom was a big influence because she would always carry a German folder. She would always carry it tucked in her waistline, kind of folded clothes and tucked in her waistline. And she would kind of put part of her t-shirt in there. So she would pull her t-shirt out and the knife would drop into her hand. And she was fast with it, not as a weapon, although she did use it once on a guy that was harassing my cousin. But she used it mostly to process meat, to process whatever, to open up bags of cookies for us. You know, she was always using a knife for something. She would always open up presents on Christmas and stuff like that. The knife itself was curved, and the handle was curved, and she would always grind a divot on the handle so she would know where the edge is when she was processing something like food or something like that, and she would scream at us to behave. She could take her eyes off the knife so she could manipulate the knife without her having to see what she was doing. That was a big influence on me, and it was purely a tool as far as my mom goes. Then I started being asked for knife designs, and I came up with this design that's basically my mom's knife. And now there's a bunch of guys in the Secret Service that carry them. There's Naval Special Warfare guys carry that knife, and my mom's somewhere up in heaven getting a kick out of how popular that thing is. You know, it's something she would make herself.
Ed's relationship with one of his brothers, Eric, also seems to have played a major role in his career choices. Eric's influence in Ed's life and his future was nothing like that of their mother and his untimely death, when Ed was only beginning his teenage years, suggests that evil he would come to face later in life might have been lurking from an early age.
I was the youngest, so my brother Eric, he was the middle brother. He passed away when he was 19. My big brother Ned, though, would take care of everything. He was a responsible one. Eric was the daredevil, the party animal, the social light. He had a load of friends every time he would make a party. That seemed like a concert. And he was pretty famous and infamous in Tijuana. Everybody knew him. He had a pretty famous friend. He used to hang out with Chalino Sanchez back when Chalino was kind of coming up and getting famous.
Chalino Sanchez was another character on the periphery of Ed's childhood that seemed to foreshadow his future career. Sanchez was a rising star in Mexico's music scene in the early 90s and was apparently a friend of Ed's brother. After playing a concert in his hometown of Sinaloa, a name that would become synonymous with cartel violence, Sanchez was found murdered. It's believed that his killers were likely in attendance at his concert that night, and his death, which is still unsolved, had all the markings of a cartel killing.
And he would play in some small bars in Tijuana, and my brother would hang around with him, right? I lost a brother. When I was 13, 14, he passed away. And there was this funeral service for him that my family had for him. It was devastating for my family. My dad, went into a cycle of depression that lasted for a long time, and it basically took away a lot of years from my mom as far as her lifespan. I could tell it took a lot. I can't imagine what it's like to lose a son like that. There was this party-like atmosphere at his funeral. I got to meet at least three girls that said that they were my brother's girlfriend, which was pretty fascinating, right? and I got to meet a lot of people that went on that came over and scrubbed my head and said, "You kind of look like your brother, make your brother proud," and all these things. And a lot of faces, a lot of people that I've never seen. And it was pretty interesting seeing how much of an influence he had on people. A lot of people came over and told me, "Hey, your brother showed me how to ride a bike," or your brother showed me how to ride a motorcycle," or your brother once drove 3 hours south of here to get me out of a ditch somewhere in the mountains. So that my brother was always kind of like that with people. He had a lot of life in him. And to this day, every now and then I bump into people, and I'm still Eric's little brother in Tijuana, which is kind of an example of how much he touched people. He's been gone for a long time now, and he's still very much alive in the minds of a few people out there. He taught me how to hunt. He taught me how to shoot a rifle. He taught me how to shoot a gun. And he also taught me how to seek out experiences. He would always goat me into doing, things like, "Hey, you want to jump this ramp with this BMX bike?" It's like, "No, I don't. That's dangerous." "Well, look at me." He does it and jumps out this ramp with this BMX bike. And then I do it myself and scrape my arm open, and there's a lot of blood, and then and then he goats me into doing it again a few weeks later, and I finally land it. That was his influence on me, being headstrong and kind of taking risks. I was 13. He hung out with a lot of people that are later on turned out to be affiliated. He had a lot of friends that when you're young and you're a kid, you don't realize who they are. And then that you grew up, and then you see them on the FBI's most wanted list, cartels, those posters that would have on your way across. Then you would recognize some of these famous faces later on. So I'm not too sure. There's always been rumors about it, but all traces of whatever happened, you know, that was back in the early 90s. There's no way of really knowing. All I can say is that I saw a lot of very, very famous faces at his funeral that later on were featured in, you know, Netflix series and stuff like that. It was around the time when this phenomenon of cartel kind of narco culture stuff like that was showing up all over the country, and I think my brother was probably part of that in a small way, or starting to be a part of it. What a lot of people don't get is suddenly deciding to go and join the government and become a government agent. That was completely countercultural. That was the most punk thing to do. I grew up skateboarding. When I was a teenager, I was more of a punk kid. I was all about that culture. And I like graffiti, I like risky behavior. And there was this weird kind of like aversion to narco culture and to everything that they would stand for. When I was growing up, that was my way of rebelling against it. You know, I tried to go the conventional route, and my whole thing was that I wanted to become a doctor and help people that way. And it was just not in the cards for me. Things happened, things shifted, and I had to choose a way to serve without going that route that most of my friends went down into. So probably the most countercultural thing that I could do, or the most punk thing that I could do, was join that police group that I was in. That was, some people out there probably experienced this before, when they have this hopeless feeling of not being able to control anything in your life. And you're unemployed and you're trying to figure yourself out. So I had one of these moments where I would basically sleep all day and stay out all night and get drunk with my friends until I started running out of money. So I had to sell my medical books. I had a girlfriend back then, and she, you know, begged me not to make the decision of going into that line of work. And talked to my mom about it before I made the decision. She advised me not to do it herself. She said that there's no parade at the end, there's no medal at the end, and you're the villain, and you're going to be the villain in the story, not the hero. I kind of looked at my options one night, just weighed all their opinions and my own. And the next day, my big brother Neto took me to the recruitment office. Did all the entry exams to see if I qualified. And 6 months later, I got the call to show up and basically be bussed out.
Next on Alchemy of Violence, hear details of one of the most dangerous and unique obstacles that came along with Ed's new career: corruption.
There's only two options: plata o plomo, you know, basically getting shot and killed or getting paid off. A lot of people go for plata. A lot of people go for plata.
And learn why Ed says most people may not realize how bad things have become in the country where he was born.
In the wrong place at the wrong time, anybody that was a military-aged male could get picked up and be confused with somebody else. And if they made a mistake about killing you, you know, 90% of all murders are never solved.
Listen to the complete season of Alchemy of Violence on Fox News Podcast Plus, starting July 12th. Fox News Podcast Plus is our new subscriber-based offering without commercials, includes bonus content, and exclusive shows like this one, exclusively on Apple Podcasts. Visit foxnewspodcast.com. Click on the Alchemy of Violence image.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by founder and executive director of Power the Future, Daniel Turner, for a look at how we can advocate for a cleaner earth while strengthening U.S. energy independence. Available now on FoxNewsPodcast.com.
Listen to Fox News Podcast shows ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or follow wherever you get your podcasts.